We have seen that whenever you do certain audits, whenever you do safety audit, you do EHS planning, you do the best practices planning, you need to have certain plan in place. Okay, it is as simple as that. You have done the safety audit and now you have put in, say for an example, fire. You have the best of firefighting system. You have fire extinguishers, you have sprinkler system, you have the fire brigade number on your phone. Everybody knows who's to call. Everybody, the ambulance system, the hospital, everything is online. But for you to do that, there has to be a certain plan in place. Let me correlate it that a fire is an unforeseen emergency. Fair enough. So then you know that in case there is a small fire, there is security guard or there is some health and safety officer who knows how to handle a fire extinguisher and douse it. Or the fire sprinkler system gets triggered and it takes care of the fire. Or if it is beyond that, then the fire brigade comes and manages it. But there has to be clear-cut thing that any employee sees it, he presses the alarm, he raises it. So that is the procedure and plan which I'm talking about. If there is an emergency which is announced, which is beyond the control of the system within that organization, that factory, site or office, then everybody has to evacuate. So all these steps which has to be carried out, the do's and don'ts and who does what, who doesn't what, who is supposed to call the hospital, who is supposed to call up the police, who is supposed to report to the senior management, who is supposed to provide first aid, and all that thing has to be documented in a document which is called as emergency plan, evacuation protocols, everything. Where is the assembly area? So there are a lot of things which have to be taken care of. Now, the five E's for accident prevention. Okay, and these are very simple to remember, and I would say that there is a 80-20 rule, Pareto rule. So if you do a lot of planning, if you spend, say, simply to put it, 80% of your time goes into audit, planning, forecasting, that will result in 20% of your time during implementation, and the probability of accidents or event happening will be lesser. So there is a lot of engineering that goes into it. You need to be very methodical. You need to be disciplined. You need to ensure that you are within the boundaries of the law, within the guidelines of safety, within the guidelines of processes wherein you don't expose yourself, your colleagues, the organization, the environment to risk. There has to be an education. Education is not only a certificate or a degree. Education comes from experience. Education comes from basically being part of situations and learning from that situation. Then, whenever you have done all that planning and you have the experience, education, you have to ensure that there is enforcement of that thing. If you identify that, what example we have seen earlier, that there is a 24-volt bulb, definitely you know that it will not go into 230 volts, so you have that education. You have to ensure that nobody does that. Okay? And for you to see that, there has to be some enthusiasm. You need to do walk-arounds. You need to assess the situation over and over again. So that is what is required. That is evaluation. You need to do audits. And why we say audits is because it is in a very structured manner. It is very focused. It has a very clear outline. I am not saying that it always has to be formal. It could be as simple as you walking around and you see that the edge of the step is broken. So definitely There is a place where somebody can trip and fall. It is not necessary that you document it only after somebody has fallen, or there is an audit 15 days from now, I will capture it then. So, accident prevention and safety is a job which you do every second. Every second. It can't be periodic, it can't be planned, it has to be spontaneous, and it has to be every time. Now, as I said, that while doing all these things, you have to analyze the situation, and it definitely comes with experience. I just gave you a simple example of the step being broken. Now, when you are analyzing a particular machine, a particular process, or particular way of work, that definitely requires some experience. So, then that person would be in a better position to identify the hazards associated with it. Now, if somebody is doing, say, a welding job, it is very simple for everybody to know that yes, he needs to wear safety glasses, he needs to have safety gloves, he needs to have safety boot, and he should hold the torch at a very safe distance. Okay, but a job safety analysis would also see at the hose of the welding torch, whether there is a leakage, the safety valve of the cylinder in which the gas is stored for you to carry out that welding. If it's a gas welding, if it's an electrical welding, then definitely he'll see that the equipment doesn't have any leakage current. So all these analysis has to be done. Every job whoever is doing has to be seen that okay, he is performing this job as per, once again I correlate, standard operating procedure. If he deviates, then what are the risks? Okay, have we covered that? Okay, because there are certain situations in which there is some deviation in SOPs, but we train and we do refresher courses for employees so that they know that this is the process and this is how it is supposed to be carried out. Now, while doing all this analysis, okay, you need to be again disciplined. You need to categorize it. If you remember earlier, we had seen the severity and probability. So it has to be in a matrix. If suppose there is job of somebody doing packaging, then it will injury while doing that. So it will be low severity, low priority. Or low probability, not priority. Okay, but there is an element of risk versus the element of risk when somebody is doing a welding or somebody is doing an electrical job of repairing a panel. So the severity is high, probability is high, okay, the exposure is high. So that will definitely be on top priority. So all the jobs have to be categorized. It has to be right from the top of the organization to the bottom of the organization. So if you have a pyramid, the apex as well as the base, everything has to be covered. And whenever you do those things, you have to identify or you have to put down the process which you followed, the observations which were. You have to also put in action plan. And once that action plan has been implemented, there has to be a follow-up. It could be a simple sheet like you did the job analysis and you found out that the electrical transformer room needs to have a security barrier. There has to be a sand bucket. Okay, fair enough. So you have put down your observation. So what is the next step? You need to give the purchase order for somebody to do that job. When he's doing that job, you ensure that he follows the work permit process, right? You follow the financial process. You ensure that it is within your budget. If not, you take proper approvals. So there are a lot of things going into that. And once everything is done, you tick mark saying that these risks were taken care of. Okay? And if there are certain risks which still stay, that also has to be highlighted. And the effects of those lists have also to be documented. Now, safety audit, again a definition. So it is precise, so it has to be taken at face value. So safety audit can be defined as study of organizations' operations and primarily to discover existing and potential hazards and the actions needed to render these hazards harmless. It is also important and useful technique to evaluate effectiveness of safety system. In case of major accident, hazard industry, yearly safety audit is compulsory as per MSIHC Act. So what this slide is trying to reiterate the fact that you need to do audits, not only formal but informal, if while your course of job at any point in time you identify that there is a risk, you need to document that risk. If you are not the owner of that activity, then you have to escalate it or highlight. As I said, there has to be a procedure, there has to be an emergency protocol, there has to be a certain thing. So you have to use the channels within the organization, highlight it to the right person, and ensure that you are within the boundaries of this rule and act. What again, we are trying to put it into certain points is what was explained earlier. How do you do an audit? So definitely there is regular routine workplace inspection, which I would say has to be daily. Okay? There has to be a very detailed checks, which is called planned preventive maintenance or planned audits has to be taken. A very exhaustive high level audits have to be done on an annual level, where if possible and if the organization permits, there has to be some external party who does it. The reason for this being that because you are within that boundary or within that area, and as you see it daily, for you it becomes routine, right? Or it becomes invisible to you, right? So if someone else does it, you would get a third eye or third party perspective of things which you are doing. Are they correct or they need to be changed or modified? Now, safety surveys are conducted, as I said, by auditors. There are safety auditors, there are organizations who do it, or there is government body or entity which does that. There is Director General Factory Advice for Security and Labor Institute. They definitely will help you with that. Then, as I said earlier, there's a Factories Act which was formed in 1948. And it was amended in 1976, wherein they have given clear-cut guidelines of how the factory should be, what are the roles and responsibilities, who is responsible for what. Everything is detailed in that act. And while doing this, the factory inspector will do regular inspections. He will liaise with the factory manager, who along with the company chairman or director, has the final responsibility for all activities that are carried within that premises factory. And it is mandatory by law that they provide safe working environment. It is necessary that if you are doing a high-risk job, you need to have that gear for you to perform that job safely and you don't injure yourself, put yourself at risk or other employees at risk. It could be a safety gear like safety belt, safety shoes, protective glasses, gloves, safety jacket, many more things. The Factories Act has many chapters, so these are the basic breakup of all those factors. The probability of risk, the safety measures which should be taken are identified as per industries. So there is a schedule of industries. There is schedule 1A, schedule 2. Then there are categories called as green, orange and red. Red being the high risk environment. All chemical industries fall under red category, I3 category. Then definitely there are prescribed schedules for it. What should be taken care of? There are definitely the benefits which you need to give, the wages. There is, you need to have occupational health center. It's called an OHC. If you have a factory, then you need to have a doctor who is there who can provide first aid. You, in certain cases, you also need to have a medical center within the premises, which can categorize to level 1 or level 2 of injuries. And you need to have all the means necessary, a tie-up with a hospital where if the risk is too high, level 3, then you can take the injured to that hospital. Schedule 3, the risk of notifiable diseases. As you might very clearly, I don't know whether you know, asbestosis is a disease which causes cancer, hence it is banned. You should not have asbestos sheet. DDT powder is also banned because it is carcinogenic, it causes cancer. So there is a lot of verbatos, there is a lot of document which is specified in the act. You definitely have consultants who know this act very well, they can also help you. That is how you, I would say, transfer risk. You involve a consultant who can help you with it and identify the hazards, help you with the processes, help you with filing, help you with all regulatory requirement. Now, there are many incidents or accidents that can occur. Okay, the most common one which we know is fire. Fire is very simple to define. It is basically when any material burns, and for any material to burn, there definitely has to be supply of oxygen. Now, whether it is a grade 1 fire, grade 2 or grade 3 fire, that depends on what is the extent of exposure to the fire. Now, all of us very clearly know that there are materials which are called hazardous. Okay, there are certain chemicals which ignite themselves even at room temperature. Okay, a simple case is like petrol and diesels, or there is called as class 1 solvents, isopropyl alcohol. There are a lot of these chemicals whose flash point or the temperature at which they can catch fire is very low. It is like between 23 and 28 degrees Celsius. It can catch fire. So these are called class 1 category solvents or chemicals. So whenever if you have a factory where you have storage of these chemicals or solvents, you need to follow the safety guidelines. You need to ensure that you do all that is necessary to prevent fire. Now, depending on what is kept, right, it is necessary that you have taken all the preventions and precautions for it, so that it doesn't become a hazardous or a accident situation. So like petrol, you definitely or diesel or kerosene, you definitely can't keep it out in the open, because a small spark here and there definitely will cause it to inflame, okay, and there would be a situation of fire, right? So depending upon what type of a chemical or compound it is, you need to ensure that all the precautions are taken so that you don't have a fire at that location. Now, there are many ways to prevent a fire. Definitely, first one is that the very basic thing is that the material, equipment, solvent or whatever it is, it's stored in a safe manner. Okay, we were talking about solvents. But now, if you have a factory where you make firecrackers, so definitely you know that gunpowder has to be safe. It can't be out in the open. It can't be next to an electrical panel, the storage. It can't be next to a place like canteen. Okay, it can't be out in the open where there is a possibility of a stray matchstick or a spark or something which can result in a disaster. So the material has to be stored safely. Okay, wherever the storage is, it should be very well protected, right? As simple as that, you can't put gunpowder in the barrel which has hole at the bottom. Or if you are storing kerosene, diesel or petrol, it can't have a leak, right? And also, if you have a lot of these requirements of raw materials for you to achieve certain products, you also should ensure that they are within the prescribed quantity. And if there are multiple such thing which are required, they are stored safely. You also need to have, as I said earlier, that you can't store a barrel of 200 liter barrel of petrol next to an electrical panel or very near the canteen, because the probability of a spark or probability of stray fire incident is much higher. Okay. Also, we all know that air is 70% nitrogen. Then there is oxygen, and then there are other gases. You should ensure that wherever these hazardous material, chemical, inflammable are stored, the oxygen level is within controllable limit. Okay, because what adds, what is fuel for the fire is not only the material which is burning, but also the oxygen. If there is no oxygen, there is no way that fire can spread. Okay, we'll reach that point in due course of time. Okay, so basically, what causes a fire? Okay, definitely mentioned here is the heat which is present. At the center of it is the chemical which is there. Suppose there is petrol, okay, then definitely the petrol, for petrol heat is required, okay, for it to reach a certain temperature where it ignites. Then definitely along with the heat you need oxygen, because if there is no oxygen, there will definitely be no fire. And you will also need more source of petrol for the fire to be consistent. Okay, so whenever there is a, as I said, there is a source which will definitely inflame, there is oxygen which is required, and there is heat, then all of these put together will cause a situation where there will be fire. Okay, if there is paper stored, we were all talking about hazardous chemicals and solvents and everything. If there is paper, right, and let me give an example. If a matchstick falls on it and it is out in the open, then definitely the paper will catch fire and there will be an incident. Now if there is paper which is wet, and even if you drop a matchstick on it, it will not burn because there is no heat. Now, if there is a dry paper, there is a mastic fallen on it, but if it is in an enclosed box where there is no oxygen, then also it will not burn, right? Even if the temperature outside is very high, the oxygen is there, but there is no fuel. Means there is no source like paper, diesel, petrol, kerosene. Definitely there will be no reaction and there will be no fire. Okay. So it is necessary whenever you are doing any kind of an audit, identify what these three elements are. Okay. Heat is definitely ambient temperature or external source. It could be a torch, it could be a flame. Oxygen is all there in the environment, but the most important point for you to find is the fuel. What will be there, which when combined with heat and the oxygen in the air will result into a chemical reaction or fire. Okay, there are certain reactions which are controlled. It is as simple as that you use all these fuels for you to attain heat or temperature using oxygen in a boiler or in a furnace. Okay, but when it happens in a godown or a storage, then it is an accident. Okay, there also there is fire in a furnace or a boiler, but it is a controlled reaction. Okay, now there are definitely various ways of fire extinguishing. Okay, now if we go back, if you take one of this element away, there will be no chemical reaction, right? Suppose if there is a stack of paper and if they are caught fire, if you take all the papers away, then after the papers which have caught fire, they burn, there will be no further fuel. If the papers are doused with water, then the heat is not there, even though the oxygen is there, the fire will go away. If the papers are there, they are burning, the heat is there, but there is no oxygen to help the reaction, then definitely the fire will not be there. So all fire extinguishing methods definitely capture one way or the other to take one of those three blocks away by which the chemical reaction will stop and the fire will get diminished or it will come under control. So as I said earlier, there is cooling method, there is smothering method. There is cooling, typically either you use a water spray or you use foam to ensure that the temperature reduces. Definitely then the heat will reduce and the fire will cool down or it will diminish. The other way is that the thing that is required for fire to burn is definitely oxygen. So if there is any way by which you can cut the supply of oxygen, again the fire will diminish. Starvation. Starvation typically is you taking the fuel away. As I said, if there is stack of papers, if there is one stack which is caught fire, if you take the remaining stacks away, definitely there is no further fuel, even though there is heat and oxygen, for the fire to continue. Now the most important part is inhibit the chain reaction. That means you have that you prevent that reaction to occur. So the fuel, the heat, and the oxygen should all not be next to each other. And even if you take that one element away, definitely there will be no such incident. As I pointed out earlier, that if you have a barrel of diesel, petrol, or kerosene, you can't keep it next to the electrical panel, or you can't keep it next to the canteen, okay? Or you can't keep it out in the open. If you have gunpowder, you can't keep it lying in the open. So it is there in a controlled environment. That is what a controlled environment prevents the chain reaction to happen. Inhibit typically means to prevent or control the situation. Now, depending upon what type of fire it is, there are extinguishers required. Definitely, if there is a fire which is caused by oil, you cannot use water because that will cause spurting of the oil and it will spread more, it will cause more injuries. So definitely based on that, there is this color coding which is there, which is required, right? Now this is definitely a table which is easy, a ready reckoner for you to identify what kind of extinguisher should be used when you encounter a certain category of fire. Okay, now if you have seen, apart from all these things, okay, if you have a server room, right, so definitely you use a dry powder, you can't use water. As I said, you can't use water for oil fires. You use foam certain for that. Carbon dioxide powder is basically because that carbon dioxide takes away the oxygen. So it is used for flammable liquids, it is used for electrical equipment. So whenever you use a fire extinguisher, it should not only prevent the or stop the fire, but it should not cause further damage to that equipment. Now let me give you a simple example. Suppose you have a toaster at home, okay, and it catches fire. Definitely you will not put water in it because then it will cause electrical short circuit. Okay, then definitely for that you can use the dry powder or carbon dioxide. You will also not use foam, okay, because foam also is water based, it comes from water. So you should use dry powder. Okay, using water and foam, okay, will also douse the fire, but it will damage that equipment and it will not be salvageable. It will completely ruin the equipment. So whenever you are using a fire extinguisher, you should use the right extinguisher for the right type of fire. Otherwise, instead of getting the fire under control, you will cause more damage.